Good morning. We're back to our twice a day because we love you twice as much. From now until, with a couple of exceptions, two services every Sunday. Make a note for yourselves that August 27th, we'll have a single service, our in-gathering every year where people bring water and perhaps other things from their travels and we mingle them all together. We'll also be blessing the backpacks and sending the kids off that day. And in order to all be together on the 27th, we'll be back at the park for that single service and our last celebration of the great outdoors before the weather does whatever it does here in Ohio. So look forward to that. We are part of the first wave of the day in Unitarian Universalist congregations across the country. In this time zone, we're lighting a chalice to remind ourselves how we come together and illuminate the world and illuminate ourselves and each other. An hour from now, that will be happening further west, and an hour from then, further west, and we are in the first wave of the day. So don't ever forget, not only are you not alone when you come here, but we are not alone when we call ourselves Unitarian Universalists.
Radical hospitality, a welcoming presence. It's a value our congregation and other churches strive for. Even our simplest actions can affect our efforts to create an open and affirming space. For example, in sharing an experience from her congregation based on trying to create a sense of welcome, the Reverend Victoria Safford writes, "Not long ago, a church member posted on Facebook a picture of a bathroom door, one of the restrooms of our church building, with the words, 'Here is just one of the reasons why I love my church.' A picture of the bathroom door. Our restroom doors have been evolving here thanks to our administrator, other staff, and many friends and members. The words and pictures on those doors speak an explicit theology, and we've been trying for some time to get it right. We are striving to express as plainly as we can the radical hospitality that is at the very core of our religion, and like all theological treatises, the signage on our doors is a work in progress. In celebration of the radical hospitality of the Unitarian Universalist faith, we welcome everyone to this worship space. The mission of our church is to inspire love, to seek justice, and to grow in community. We are glad you took the time to join us today, and we hope you find the nourishment that can sustain you in the coming week and inspiration to help you live your values in the world. Come, let us worship together."
Before we enter a time of silence, shared together in the manner that suits your spirit, let's take a moment and think about your biggest concern, the thing that keeps you awake when you need to sleep. Just hold that in your mind for a moment, and then let's have a deep breath and just let it out. You won't lose it. Just let it out. And we help hold those concerns. And think of why you get anxious. What is it that brings anxiety into your life? What feeds it? Let's take a moment to think of what feeds your anxiety and take a deep breath, let it out, and stop feeding it. And in the silence, we'll now hold together. Carry into that your joys, your sorrows, the news that concerns you, the news that delights you. We will return from silence momentarily. May the Spirit of God, who is our Mother, Father, the Spirit in which we live and move and breathe, which is the unknowable, the mystery from whence we came, be with us always as we are with each other. In our lonely moments, let's remember that we are close to each other and to others who care. When we feel the warmth of those near us, when we feel the air move in the room as they pass, let us note our awareness, our closeness, and that we are not indeed alone. In this world full of injustice, where there's cruelty and violence, which causes fear and anxiety, may we forgive and be forgiven our moments of pettiness. In times when we're surrounded by hostility and aggression, may we forgive and be forgiven our moments of anger. May we learn eventually to move beyond the need to forgive and be forgiven and arrive at a place of honoring and celebrating the human condition in all our complex and astonishing variety. All we have to do is realize how connected we are, how alike we are. But for not arriving there yet, for being clumsy along the way or forgetting where we're going, may we forgive ourselves and be forgiven. Let's awaken to the beauty that surrounds us. Let's awaken to the beauty in each other. Let's awaken to the beauty in ourselves. And with that, I say, amen.
Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to all on this day? Run to the rock, rock, won't you hide me? Run to the rock, rock, won't you hide me? Run to the rock, won't you hide me all on this day? Run to the rock, rock was a melting. Run to the rock was a melting. Run to the rock was a melting all on the day. Run to the sea, sea was boiling. Run to the sea, sea was boiling. To the sea, sea was boiling all on that day. Run to the moon, moon was bleeding. Run to the moon was bleeding. Run, moon, moon was bleeding all on that day. Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Sinner man, where you gonna run to all on that day? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me all on that day? The Lord said, sinner man should have been praying. Sinner man, you should have been praying. I said, sinner man, you should have been praying all on that day. Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? Oh, sinner, you gonna run to? Oh, sinner man, where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Our reading today is from one titled The Gift of Sin. It's an excerpt from that by the Reverend Suzelle Lynch. On a sunny day in September, a stern-faced, plainly dressed man could be seen standing still on a street corner in the busy Chicago Loop. As pedestrians hurried by on their way to lunch or business, he would solemnly lift his right arm and, pointing to the person nearest him, intone loudly, "Guilty." Without any change of expression, he would resume his stiff stance for a few moments, and then, again, the inexorable raising of his arm, the pointing, and the solemn pronouncement of the one word, "guilty." The effect of this strange pantomime on the passing strangers was extraordinary. They would stare at him, hesitate, look at each other, look back at him again, then hurriedly continue on their way. One man, turning to another, was heard to exclaim, "But how did he know?" So writes Dr. Carl Menninger in his book, Whatever Became of Sin. Guilty. If someone on the street suddenly pointed at you and pronounced you guilty, what would come to your mind? Of what sins are you guilty? Overwork? Self-indulgence? Guilty of a few little white lies? Overdue library books? guilty of uncharitable thoughts, of raising your voice or your hand to another person in anger, of keeping the extra $5 the cashier gave you in error when you paid for a purchase, guilty of judging harshly someone whose beliefs or opinions are different from yours, or perhaps you're guilty of one of the good old seven deadly sins: envy, anger, pride, sloth, avarice, gluttony, or lust. All of us, it seems, have cause to feel at least a little guilty about something. I agree with the idea of the innate human capacity for goodness, but I think we do ourselves a radical disservice when we reject the concept of sin entirely. Indeed, I believe that a grounded moral and spiritual life requires an understanding of sin. We need a definition of sin that helps us cope with our lived experience, how we feel when we have violated our cherished values or when someone has trespassed against us. We need a definition of sin that acknowledges our failings and the reality of evil in the world, but also recognizes the possibility of our goodness. And if we can find this definition of sin, we might even find that sin can be kind of a gift. So if you ever pass a street corner preacher shouting, "Repent," or the next time you feel a twinge of conscience nagging in a small corner of your mind, the next time someone dear to you flinches and you don't know why, before moving on to the next thing in your life, pause for a moment and listen. For the voice of wholeness calls to us in many ways if we will only pay attention.
I wish I had a mirror, a great big mirror I could put up here, but it has to have auditory properties too, because to hear you sing, it's an amazing thing. I don't know a congregation this size that can sing that in both parts, and they come through, and it gets better with each repetition. It's so impressive, and I wish you could see it, by which I mean really experience what it sounds like when you're all singing in one direction. And there are seven metaphors in there for a happy and full life, including the singing in one direction. And I often suggest being mindful about pausing at least once a day. Just pause and look in the mirror. Do something like say, "Hi, beautiful." Because I want to encourage that or any activity that leads to a moment of self-awareness and appreciation. Because really, whoever you are, wherever you come from, whatever you've messed up in life, whatever your successes are, whatever your failures are, you're pretty awesome. You made it this far. You're here. You're with people who care. That's pretty amazing. I want that mirror too. I want it writ large, and I want us to never forget it. But on a daily practice, just pause, look at yourself in the mirror. That can have complex results, not all the ones expected. You ever do that and then see a different version of yourself? I can speak with some specificity about that, but I'm thinking an example when I was young, maybe 12. I might gaze long enough to see what I thought I would look like when I was older. Just look in the mirror and think of all the people who had apparently created me, and I'd start to merge all the images in my mind and in the mirror. And I don't know that I did that on purpose, but I recall it happening. And at some point, you just kind of go, "Whoa, whoa," and you stop looking because you lose who you are in the moment. But it's an opportunity for time travel in a way. But I created a gap between who I actually was in the moment and who I imagined myself to be. I know that many of us, as we improve with age, we sometimes look in the mirror and we see our younger self. And that's okay. That younger self is part of what made us who we are. It's still in there. But it's different for me now. There's still a gap when I'm surprised at who I see in the mirror. I do know my younger self evolved into this, quite different on the surface. But moments when I can't see myself realistically are times when I fail to mind the gap between my self-image and my reality. It all began with Adam. He was the first man to tell a joke or a lie. How lucky Adam was, Mark Twain wrote enviously in his notebook in 1867. Twain says he knew when he had said a good thing, nobody had said it before. Adam was not alone in the Garden of Eden, however, and doesn't deserve all the credit. Much credit is due to Eve, the first woman, and Satan, the first consultant. Adam was but human. This explains it all. He didn't want the apple for the apple's sake. He wanted it because it was forbidden. The mistake was in not forbidding the serpent. Then he would have eaten the serpent. Adam and Eve entered the world naked and unashamed, naked and pure-minded, and no descendant of theirs has ever entered it otherwise. All have entered it naked, unashamed, and clean in mind. They have entered it modest. They had to acquire immodesty and the soiled mind, and there was no other way to get it. Thank you, Mark Twain. We create these gaps. The world helps us create a gap between who we want to be and who we can be. Helps us feel disappointed, helps us feel disconnected. And that's why we come together, to remind ourselves implicitly or explicitly that we're not alone and we can call each other to our best selves. I do my best to heed the words that Ralph Waldo Emerson passed on to the graduating class at Harvard Divinity School in 1836. This is a famous thing that I hope they're still teaching everyone who is on the path to becoming a Unitarian Universalist minister. Emerson had grown tired of being a Unitarian minister, mostly because he didn't see and hear enough passion from his colleagues. They were slipping off into intellectualism, lacking the passion in the heart that he was craving. His words both inspire and haunt preachers. Speaking of a colleague, at a graduation talk, Emerson said, "If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. The true preachers can be known by this, that they deal out to people their lives passed through the fire of thought." And within any life, we find topics such as morality, mortality, justice, dreams, visions, communication, miscommunication, love and loss and privilege, all these inevitabilities of being human. We talk about everything: queerness, hope, memory, plans, relationships, abundance, scarcity, and everything else. We speak of love and waiting, of grief and of gratitude. We look at realities, race, age, class, gender identities, other identities, sexual orientations, actual human conditions, realities of being human. We look at these because we are here. Because we're here. I mean, because we are here in this church, not another church. I mean, because we are here in Kent, not another place. I mean, because we are here as human beings. We come together with all of our issues, and sometimes we have to be reminded how connected we are. Every one of us feels loss, sometimes deep and agonizing, and we grieve. And as someone wrote to me after the service last week, grief is the night, mourning will come. And we learn to carry our mourning throughout our lives once we process our grief. And that is the way of things. We each have moments of connection and moments of disconnection with our best selves. We each fail and succeed from time to time, and we each create gaps between ourself and our best self. Right inside, we create our own gap. We create a gap between ourself and those around us, and between us and that which is greater than us. There's a word for it. Sin. It causes separation. That's all it means. We get hung up on words, but this is pretty straightforward. Religion is all about putting us back together, reuniting us with wherever we came from. Kind of doesn't matter. Sin is the word for what takes us apart in the first place. It's all the broken things. We are constantly being taken apart and put back together, and that's why we're here. And we contribute to both of those, usually by accident, usually not mindfully. So we have to mind that gap. I grew up thinking of sin as breaking some rules. I was Catholic. The rules were harsh, but vague. The punishment was harsher and seemed out of proportion. It was nebulous and scary and possibly eternal. And as a child, that was kind of crazy. Eventually, I learned to reframe this in valid ways, I must say. Sin is simply that which separates. It's the wedge that drives us apart from our best selves and from those around us, from our God. Some people in some places use the word in ways similar to how I understood it as a child, and it can be hard to translate. But I guarantee you, we all do this thing. We all do this thing that separates us from each other. We look the other way. We lie. We deceive. We make stuff up. We do these things, every one of us. But the rules, those harsh and vague rules, that might be the first sin. It really might. In vagueness and imagination, they become an obstacle to relationship. We're walking on eggshells all the time. It's an obstacle to connection. Rules can create the very gap we try to close. Underneath the rules we grow up with or create for ourselves, there are a couple of core directives. We can take the big rule book, set it over there, and say two things. Be honest. Don't be mean. Let's start with that. You can memorize that. You can get that as a tattoo right here. It's very brief. It wouldn't hurt very much, right? Be honest, don't be mean. That's one do and one don't. There's a huge gap between that core understanding and the giant rule book. So set the rule book aside. And think about how we are different than we used to be. This congregation is different than it used to be, even quite recently. And you know what? It doesn't go back to what it was, and we don't go back to what we were. Let's think about that. Let's put that through the fire of thought together. So get out your matchbooks and, no, let's not do that. But I'll just use myself as an example. You know some of this story. My life is nothing exceptional, really. I used to be younger. I used to be skinny. I was closeted. Then I was married. I used to be male. I used to be a Westerner. My life changed and I changed, and I can't go back to who I was. This church has changed. It's soon to change even more. Time changed. The town changed. The church changed, of course. Every one of us has changed, even though we may favor seeing a younger version of ourselves in the mirror. In the clear light of day, we know what's real and what we imagine, and we're really good at not obsessing about that, not paying that much attention to what's real when it's uncomfortable. Time has altered us all, and all of our endeavors are altered by time. And this part of truth lives in numbers, the clock and the calendar, days and years, as well as eras. Back to my life, there was a time when I tried to blame people who had left me. Maybe you have too. My family left me in many ways as the youngest child, and, you know, it wasn't exceptional. I never starved. I was never physically abandoned. Mother was just obsessed with her own life and ultimate early death, and my absent, overworking father died soon after. I'd been the one left at home while all my siblings had gone out ahead of me. So for years, that was my existence. And there was a time, and maybe many times, this was so long ago, when I blamed them for leaving me. But it wasn't about me. People don't leave because of you or me. My family didn't leave. They just didn't know me. They just missed out. Although I may still wish it had been otherwise, I may mourn their absence in my life, I need not grieve it. I'm a grown up now. I've had decades to consider, and I spent too many of the years grieving. Blame is part of grief, by the way. I blame myself, though, for not being good enough to keep them. I blame God for creating the mess, and I blamed everything I could think of, because it's hard to comprehend why you get left. I did quite a bit to contribute to the separation, I suppose, the gap, the sin of the situation. I also realized that I could do a great deal to bring it back together. Not with them, they are gone, long gone, but with me, the gap inside. The needed forgiveness was complex in a way. Once I realized that no one was to blame for being absent, I noticed that it was not them I needed to forgive. It's not them I need to blame. It's not them who did anything. It was myself. They just happened to miss out on knowing me. That was a shame of sorts. But I'm the one who blamed, and I had to discover a way to forgive myself. It's the only one I can truly affect. Yourself is the only one you can truly affect. And the little gaps inside of our spirit. It's a little slice illuminated in this place on this day, but why now? Why talk about sin in a Unitarian Universalist church? It's not our custom. It's just a word. It's a nice, convenient word, short, to the point. It invites us to take off the baggage of things we might have attached to a word that has a real purpose, a real meaning. And in the same way, it allows us to set aside all the rules and just consider a couple. Be honest. Don't be mean. Just try that on. But remembering people who are no longer in our lives may bring up some feeling. Some of it may be grief. Some of it may be mourning. Some of it may be blaming. I'm never happy about those who I felt should have been more present in my life, but I've learned something. I've learned, perhaps by applying to my own life, the practice I apply to my task of dealing out my life to you. I've learned this thing about forgiveness and how tricky it can be. So in my life, I was left, and too soon, by my family. I can wish that it had been different, but the wishing does nothing for me. And it fails to acknowledge the reality of those I might have wanted to blame. On the one hand, had my parents been more responsible and really wanted a kid, had they been more responsible when they didn't want a kid, I would not have been born. But they made the accident. That's not on me. And I lost my place because I turned that upside down. I like to think I would be mad about not being born, but that does enter into quite a paradox, doesn't it? If they had, on this hand, really wanted me, planned for me, and made room for me, who's to say that would have actually played out any better? They were still going to leave. They were still going to die. I was still going to be the one left. It isn't personal. People leave because they leave. That's all. Things change, not because of good or bad, but because things and people must change. I have a favorite passage from the book, The Kite Runner. You'll hear this from me more than once, or parts of it. This is the longest version. In this scene, one child takes the blame for another, admitting to a theft they did not commit. The true thief, the narrator, Amir, and this was a fairly minor incident of a stolen watch, but Amir was torn between wanting to confess, to be accountable for his actions, and wanting to move on. He says, I would have told, except that a part of me was glad that this would all be over soon. Baba would dismiss them. There would be pain, but life would move on. I wanted that, to move on, to forget, to start with a clean slate. I wanted to be able to breathe again. So Amir was ready to tell the truth that he had stolen the watch. Someone else confessed falsely. In the story, one is a legitimate child, the other is not, but doesn't even know it. It's like a soap opera in Afghanistan. It's a wonderful, rich book with passages like this. So Baba stunned him by saying to the one who confessed falsely, I forgive you. Amir is thinking, forgive, but theft was the one unforgivable sin, the common denominator of all sins. When you kill someone, you steal a life. When you tell a lie, you steal someone's right to the truth. When you cheat, you steal the right to fairness. There is no act more wretched than stealing. Hadn't Baba sat me on his lap and said those words to me? Then how could he just forgive? And if Baba could forgive that, then why couldn't he forgive me for not being the son he'd always wanted? Why? Later, sometime in the middle of the night, our writer sees a picture and does some processing, putting his own life through the fire of thought, which comes out like this. I slipped out of bed and went to Sohrab's room. I stood over him, looking down, and saw something protruding from under his pillow. I picked it up, saw it was Rahim Khan's Polaroid, the one I had given to Sohrab the night I had sat by the Shah Faisal Mosque, the one of Hassan and Sohrab standing side by side, squinting in the light of the sun, smiling like the world was a good and just place. I wondered how long Sohrab had lain in bed, staring at the photo, turning it in his hands. I looked at the photo. Your father was a man torn between two halves, Rahim Khan had said in his letter. I had been the entitled half, the society-approved, legitimate half, the unwitting embodiment of Baba's guilt. I looked at Hassan, showing those two missing front teeth, sunlight slanting on his face. Baba's other half, the unentitled, unprivileged half, the half who had inherited what had been pure and noble in Baba, the half that maybe, in the most secret recess of his heart, Baba had thought of as his true son. I slipped the picture back where I had found it. Then I realized something. That last thought had brought no sting with it. Closing Sohrab's door, I wondered if that was how forgiveness budded. Not with the fanfare of epiphany, but with pain, gathering its things, packing up, and slipping away unnoticed in the middle of the night. And in this story, the answer is yes. That's how forgiveness buds. In my life, it's been much the same. No fanfare, just surrender, fatigue from the gap between this and that, between me and them, between me and my best self. It gets weary, and we surrender. In this time, in this place, for you, for me, in this life, at this time, forgiveness buds just like that, or even blossoms, like things do in the spring. We can always help pain gather its things and pack, and it will slip away in the middle of some night. And we'll notice someday when we look in the mirror afterwards, we're a little bit more beautiful. Upon waking, we'll be responsible for our own future. We may wish something had been different in our past. We may wish someone didn't leave. But now, especially now, as we're entering a season of hope and expectation and reflection and abundance, we'll appreciate all that has been and our contribution to all that has been, that we may have life and have it more abundantly. I say again, amen.
The ushers, please come forward. So we've been in sort of church summer mode, and now we're kind of moving back into our regular schedule. And I've noticed there seems to be like building energy happening in the church. So we have our ministerial searches moving along. We have good news from our building team that after having to overcome some obstacles, they're feeling energy about moving forward. We'll have our in-gathering at the end of the month, and that will kick off our very energetic RE program. And so sort of in the spirit of appreciating all of the good energy and vitality we feel around the church, we accept today's offering.
Really, we need that great big mirror, that auditory mirror, that tactile mirror, because now we get to close the gap between us with the extensions of our body that reach out the furthest would be our hands, our amazing hands that have carried us this far as we carry each other and as we allow others to carry us. There are so many gaps in life between what we want and what we do to get it, between what we believe and how we act, between how we want to be treated and how we treat others. And that's the human condition, is to have these gaps around us. So just like on the tube in London where you go to step on and there's a sign that says, mind the gap. Don't fall in there. That's where our title came from. Don't fall in there. Don't fall in there. We're here to hold each other and make sure we don't fall in the gap. Take a moment to think about the magic mirror that I just thought of. Think about how beautiful you really are, how much you really give to the world. It's amazing. Even if it's not enough, even if it's too much, it's amazing what we do with our lives. So do more of the good stuff. Go in peace. Spread it around. Return in love. Spread that around too. Amen.